Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. Today we'll be having a conversation with Linda Huaki, who's a PhD candidate in Civilization Studies at Ibn Haldun University, Istanbul. Her PhD thesis and broader research interests focus on Islamophobia and convert Muslims. She has done fieldwork interviews with converts from Finland, her native country, exploring the question of whiteness, Finnishness, identity, and recognition. She's currently the coordinator of Anti-Muslim Racism Working Group at the European Coalition of Cities Against Racism. And along with some other consultancy work, she's also the General Secretary of European Forum of Muslim Women. Currently, she lives with her Bosnian husband in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Among many other things, we talk about the intersection of the identity of being a convert, of being Finnish, of being white, of being a Muslim. Before we get started, though, I just want to remind you, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a review and share it with friends and family. Let's get started. Assalamu alaikum, Linda.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
It's very exciting for me as well. I'm going to launch right into it. I wanted to ask you, how are you finding the grad school process, especially considering where you grew up, where you're now, and all the places you've studied in? How has that been for you?
Right. Yeah. So actually, I just realized that I have, from my master's onwards, I have pretty much been abroad for the school. I did my bachelor's in Finland, which is my native country. And then for the master's, I went to Germany. And ever since, I've been abroad. I've been an expat or an immigrant. I don't know which word we should use. I left Finland in 2008. And now I'm living in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I lived in between also in Jordan for a year, and then I spent 6.5 years in Turkey. And so it's been quite a tour that I have done so far, and alhamdulillah, now I'm finally settled. I'm not going anywhere else anymore. I was thinking about the journey as such, you know, today, and it's been interesting because, you know, I'm a convert Muslim, and I kind of had to kind of reflect the way how I have always been the other, you know, like even, okay, when I was still in Finland, it was very interesting. I actually came to Islam when I was in my undergrad studies. I was the only hijabi in the university. There was absolutely nobody else. Yeah, it was quite a, you know, like I was kind of very, how to say, you know, people could notice me very easily, obviously. But alhamdulillah, there was no like negative attitudes, or I didn't have any trouble at the university.
Alhamdulillah.
Back then, no. But I remember once I was on campus and I saw this other girl, she had a hijab, and I saw her, you know, like just walking across the campus area. And I was like, oh my goodness, there is another person like me on this campus. And guess what? She was also a Finnish convert girl. So I literally just ran to her and I was like, hey, who are you? You know? And it was super cool. I mean, we're still friends actually with that girl, and mashallah. But you know, actually Finland today, it's a little bit different. That was what, I think 2006 or 7 when I was still in the undergrad. But now they have Muslim student associations there and everything. So the situation has changed, alhamdulillah, even there. Yeah. Well, then I moved to Germany for my master's studies, and I was doing an interdisciplinary program called Language, Culture and Translation. And it was a blessing because the university that I was studying in, which is Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz, we had our campus for that specific study program was in a smaller town apart from mother campus, or how you would call it.
Yeah, the main campus, yeah.
Yeah, the main campus. There were other Muslims there, you know, it was new to me because one of the languages offered in the translation program was Arabic. They also had Turkish. Yeah, so I found a lot of other people who looked like me, so to say. Yeah, I mean, in that sense, it was very interesting. And then, of course, spending 6.5 years in Turkey in my PhD studies was something very, very different, though, you know, because you have that minority perspective from Finland and Germany. Even in Germany, I was still a foreigner, but that didn't matter that much because, as I said, campus was very, very international. So everybody was kind of, you had a lot of students coming from abroad.
Yeah, there's a lot of international student population.
Yeah, exactly. But then in Turkey, it was like completely different because then you are like in a Muslim majority country and suddenly you're not that different anymore. So it was very interesting. There you kind of have to deal more with maybe anxieties that have to do really with the culture as such. Yeah, I was a Muslim and I had already been Muslim for several years. But, you know, living now in a Muslim majority country, that was very different.
Now, did you encounter the attitude that because you're a convert, you may not know as much about as we do kind of thing as born? You know, so I've noticed sometimes that people who are born into a religion have like this attitude that we know, let us show you.
Yeah.
Did you encounter those kinds of attitudes as well?
Well, I mean, actually, not that much, because the thing is this, that I guess I was the, I'm always making a joke about this and I might be a little, I don't know, rude to myself. I guess I was kind of like the bad immigrant there, if we want to say so. You know how we have like those stereotypes of immigrants not intermingling with majority population?
Right.
I mean, I don't subscribe to that word at all myself, bad immigrant and good immigrant. I think that is totally polarizing. But just like looking at myself being there on the campus and then spending most of the time with other international students again, I didn't really have much connections with the Turkish people. It was interesting that sometimes, you know, when I would go to the mosque, for example, for prayers, then there would be, yeah, some once I remember, alhamdulillah, we have prayer rooms on the campus. So I went to do my prayers there in between the classes. And then there was this cleaning lady from the university. She was very sweet. But after I was done with my duhur prayer, she kind of came to me and she was talking to me in Turkish. And back then I was a new student. I didn't much understand of Turkish language anyway. And she was trying to explain to me and I was like, what does she want from me? And then I noticed she started mimicking the prayer movements and she was like, oh, you have to do it like this, you have to do it like that. And it was about the positioning of the arms.
Right.
And I was like,
I've been there.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, teşekkürler. Like, thank you. Okay, thank you so much. And in my head, I was thinking, my dear sister, I wish that you would know that people pray in different manners, that I might not be of your school, you know,
right, because, right.
Obviously, they are mostly Hanafis in Turkey, and they have like a certain way of prayer. But I was like, what does it matter? You know, I would just, she had good intentions, and I just let it be. And I was happy that she was trying to be helpful, of course. But otherwise, I never encountered anything like that, because
alhamdulillah.
Yeah, even at school, you know, it was mostly, we had even other converts, which was very comfortable for me as such. We had from other countries, we had converts from Holland, converts from France, Russia. It was very interesting, all of these people coming to this one campus in Turkey, doing studies there together. There was very little negativeness over there, I would say.
That's really wonderful to hear. Speaking of sort of negative experiences, I wanted to ask, I know you've worked several types of jobs as a grad student in areas of diplomacy, in areas of international affairs. And I wanted to ask, like, what kind of insights can you give to the struggles of grad students gaining professional experience while they're working on their thesis? Do you think students should be encouraged to work outside the campus at all, or just focus on finishing up and graduating?
This is actually a very important thing to me personally, obviously, because I've been struggling with it myself, and I'm sure that a lot of people do struggle. I think we had this conversation with a couple of fellow students this past month in a student group on WhatsApp. And I think I was privileged because my university offered me a scholarship in Turkey. However, as I came to decide on my thesis topic, I was, by God's grace, I was offered opportunities to work in that same field, or at least work a job that is connected to the same field.
That's pretty amazing.
And earn money, which was way more than the scholarship. And I took those opportunities and I made those decisions. I was actually discouraged from it by my professors. The university as such doesn't really encourage that kind of activity because they want you to...
Why do you think that your advisor was discouraging in the moment?
Yeah, So that's like, because they want you to just focus on your thesis. You know, you have a scholarship, you can just focus on your thesis. Of course, you have to, for the scholarship at the same time, be a teaching assistant or a research assistant with the university. They just want you to, because they say that PhD is a full-time job. So you can't do anything else alongside of that. I think here is exactly the very important point, because in Turkey, the school system, when you do a PhD, you have 6 years time. It's like 6 years and nothing else. However, within those 6 years, especially when you are in grad school, our program is civilization studies. You have first, we did 1 year of Turkish language, and then we did 1 year of courses, and then you have the comprehensive exams. It's very similar to the States in that sense. You prepare a half a year for the comprehensive exam, and then after that, you basically have half a year time to write your proposal, get it accepted, and then start working on the thesis. So at the end of the day, what you basically have left from your time of study is roughly 2-3 years. And that's the time that you would have to basically use for writing the thesis only. For me, that happened that I then got those job offers. And I have to admit, it took a lot of my time to go and work elsewhere than on my thesis. You know, I was working in the university as a research associate, which was another university than the one that I was doing my thesis for. Oh, wow. And then I went into work with the Islamic Cooperation Youth Forum, ICYF. And I do admit it took a lot of time from me. However, I gained so much, so much more. And ironically, I am now saying it, I'm kind of like, at this point of time, I'm actually in my last year of my PhD study time, last semester, and only within the last 6 months, I have had the feeling that I actually know what I want to write.
Alhamdulillah, that's an amazing feeling to have.
Yeah, and it's like so ironic, because I remember myself back then in 2017, I had my proposal accepted, and I had an idea. I want to write about anti-Muslim racism or Islamophobia in my native country, Finland, and I'm looking into convert Muslim experiences. And I went and I did my field work, and I went to Finland, I did interviews, and I knew nothing, literally nothing about the topic as such. I had read for the proposal, you have to do a literature review and all of that, but at the end of the day, there was no kind of an amalgam of ideas or kind of like an overview of the whole approach that I want to take when I am looking at this phenomenon and of this issue of convert Muslims situated in the Finnish society and having those experiences of Islamophobia.
Yeah.
However,
go ahead. No.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that those jobs that I had and I did, because they were all connected somehow topically to anti-Muslim racism, they kind of like widened my perspective in a manner that I do not believe that ever only sitting in the library and reading articles and reading books would have been able to do.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I think that's something that if you can get a job that's near adjacent to what you're working on, then yeah, that's extremely valuable experience. And then the other thing I think that's very common among grad students that they may not be aware of as they're going through the process is that it's not up until very, very late in the process that you have a fully formulated plan or what you're working on, because, and then throughout that journey, we're like freaking out because we're like, oh my God, where is this headed?
Yeah.
And then eventually it forms into, and it may look very different from your prospectus and from the proposal that you submitted, but it's not until the very, very end that you actually get that idea. So I'm glad you got those experiences. Speaking of your project, how did you get interested in whiteness as constructed in Finland?
So that's also kind of like related to the jobs that I did. I actually I think it was back in 2016, while I was still in my course year, 15 or 16, I came across this call for papers or call for contributions to the European Islamophobia Report, which has been for years now edited and published by Dr. Farid Hafez and his colleague, Dr. Enes Bayrakli. They were looking for writers for Finland for the country chapter of Finland. And back then, I hadn't even yet decided that I will write about Islamophobia in my country for my PhD. And I saw that call for contributions, and I was like, I think I should apply. This sounds very interesting. And I think this kind of a research is something that I would want to do. And then when I was actually writing my first country chapter for that report, I figured out that this topic of Islamophobia and racialization and the way how Muslims are treated in Finland and elsewhere in Europe, as well as USA, this is something that I'm really interested in. And that's how it came that I actually even started with the whole topic. Then what happened is that while I was doing the research for my country chapters, I was moving around this Facebook, you have like groups for certain kind of purposes. And there was an anti-racism group for Finnish people, like, you know, Finnish activists, right. Everyday Joes and Janes, you know, who are interested in anti-racism. So I was there in the group and I posted a question, all right? And I was like, hey guys, dear group members, da 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 da, and would you know of some websites or some Facebook groups that are spreading anti-Muslim hatred? Because I was doing that social media section for the report, media reporting and analyzing. And then what happened is that I became a target of cyber harassment for the reason that there was, so to say, I don't know how you call it, a mole, maybe. There was there was a person in that group who wasn't an anti-racist at all.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And he picked up on that post of mine. He took a screenshot of it and he sent it to a couple of his connections. And one of these connections was a back then very well-known fake news website in Finnish language. And it was very well known for very blatant racist content. They were attacking a lot of individuals, even politicians, journalists, and all that sorts of stuff. And I found my face on one of the in one of the articles of that fake news website. And it was just
so
like,
scary.
Yeah, so it was just like straight on harassment, straight on slander, traitor, brainwashed. I don't even want to go into the, you know, all the sexual stuff that was written about me, you know, how they kind of like sexualize Muslim women and, you know, objectify them and all of that stuff. Then what happened is that I got private messages on Facebook, you know, threats, you know, oh, when you come back home, we will be waiting for you at the airport, this and that, da, da, da. Absolutely horrible. Yeah. And I was just, you know, like a newbie in the research. And I was scared, you know, I was like, what on earth is happening? I literally just, is this what it's going to, like, is my life over? Is my reputation gone? You know, because if you Googled my name back then, you would find all of this trash about me that these people wrote, these Islamophobes, they wrote about me. And it was just very scary time. And it culminated into this absolutely ridiculous thing. This guy took it to him, took it as his project to, I don't know what, scare me or something like that. But he literally, he phoned the Turkish embassy in Helsinki.
And what?
And he told them, there is this and that named girl in Istanbul. She's studying in the university. She's a Muslim convert and she's totally wacko. She's crazy. She's an extremist and she's a potential terrorist.
Oh my God. That would, oh my God. I don't even know how you dealt with that.
Me neither. I don't know. So what happened is that the Turkish embassy took this phone call very seriously and I received a phone call from the anti-terrorism police department in Istanbul one day and they basically invited me for interrogations. However, by that day that I went for the interrogations and they said to me, do you know why you're here? And I was like, well, actually, you know, I was playing a little bit dumb. I was like, no, I don't. Tell me, why am I here? And then they were like, yeah, okay, we got this phone call and we have to be super careful because you know how the situation is. What was the situation? This was around 2016. That was the time when we had this huge issue of people traveling from Europe to Turkey and then further to Syria for war activities. So they said that we have to take all of this stuff kind of seriously. And that's why we have invited you here. I told them, I said, listen, guys, this is all about online harassment and I know what's going on. I had taken screenshots of everything. I had so much material. I had so much evidence for myself. I told them, you can phone this place. I mean, this think tank that is publishing the report, basically. So this is legit stuff that I'm doing. I had actually two people from my university with me. They were from the international office because the rector of the university was concerned that I would get into trouble. So they offered me help. So they were there also to speak for me and help me with the language. Yeah. And I just provided with them with all the materials, and they were like, okay, we will take this into consideration, and thank you so much. And I had to give my statement. That was like, you know, the Sunday spent there at the police station. After that experience, I, of course, I mean, later, you know, for you and for listeners, I should say that I was, of course, cleared of any issues, you know, like my name was cleared and there was no problem at all. I mean, they also realized that it was just a scam. Right. But after this experience, I kind of realized that it's kind of very, very worrying how the fact that a person changes their religious identity, or not even changes the identity, but when a person chooses another religion, how you become so much of the other that you can become a target of such an action, such a mission, that this one random guy, like some everyday Joe from Finland, he just decided that I hate this person so much, I want to make her life so much difficult only because she's now a Muslim and she's a traitor, and I don't accept that I'm going to go and I'm going to make this phone call and I'm going to, you know, ruin her life.
Yeah, you know? I mean, so essentially you were white prior to your conversion, and when you converted, you were no longer white in his eyes.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You're now a race traitor.
Exactly. I was a race traitor. I mean, this is exactly, I never thought about whiteness or my whiteness before, you know, even many, many years I was Muslim. And when I wasn't dealing with Islamophobia, and obviously until my PhD studies, and only after I started dealing with the topic and I started being active myself, that's what is there, that, you know, kind of like triggering thing, that the fact that I was making that, I was doing that research, and I was kind of like poking in the hornet's nest, that's what made these people so angry. And it was just crazy, because, I mean, the fact that I wouldn't anymore, these people, they didn't consider me anymore as a Finn. It's like, you know, she has traded her culture. She has, you know, whatever, by converting to Islam. And now she is, you know, one of the arguments on the internet that I read was that she is conspiring against, you know, her own, like, from Turkey, I was conspiring against my people. I'm putting this in quotation marks here. Nobody can see it, of course. But my people, you know, in Finland. So that's kind of like, that's how I realized this issue of whiteness and racialization, and how much intertwined it is with issues of religion and Muslimness in Europe. And I'm sure this is the case in the US as well.
Definitely. I did have a white convert friend who, she said, the number of times people have screamed at me, go back to where you came from. And
yeah.
She's like, I don't know where that from is, you know, right now. Like, should I go back like three generations before and move back to Germany because my ancestors are German? Like,
right.
I don't know what you're saying.
So,
I mean, you definitely are racialized differently as soon as you don the hijab, or can be identified as Muslim just from the look at you.
Yeah. And the interesting thing here also, I think, is that, as I said, I had never thought about whiteness as a social construct before. And I never had really realized that I am a white person.
Right.
And but I'm a white person with a small W, but then also a capital W.
Right.
So, I mean, there is that both. I am what I am. My skin color is what it is as such, but I am also carrying that kind of like load of whiteness on my shoulders as such.
Yeah.
And there is so much privileges connected to it. I wasn't aware of before because I had not thought about it, because nobody challenged me to think about it.
Right.
And it has just been so eye-opening, especially when I've been dealing with, you know, lots of international people in Turkey. I've seen refugees and I've seen international students, refugees who are international students, looking at their struggles and all of that. And then also kind of like thinking about the way how it was somehow, You know, sometimes I felt ashamed of the privilege that I was carrying, you know, with me coming from Europe, because there were all kinds of rumors like, oh, as a European, you will earn more money in Turkey than the Turkish person would with the same qualifications. Or, wow. Yeah, or just like even the fact that, you know, I'm a convert Muslim. How many times have I been asked to go to give an interview because of my conversion or something like this? It's like, we're always very interesting to people.
Right.
So that is like the kind of weird whiteness and that kind of like from that perspective, from that, you know, from Muslim perspective, kind of like that romanticization of whiteness in a sense, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Like, you know, what is the positionality of converted Muslims, both in your encounters, but also in Finnish society in particular?
Yeah. So that is exactly the thing that, I mean, it's always like you have that fascination of the others, like, oh my God, mashallah, you're a Muslim and that's so nice and you are guided and, you know, all of that excitement from other Muslims. And then I would say that even people expect you to be like super, I don't know, like a role model, maybe role model
right.
in religion.
There's like a certain expectation of converts
yes,
that is
exactly.
not of. Like if you see a convert doing something that you consider un-Islamic practice,
yeah.
you're thinking, oh, they've reverted back to their original religion.
Yes.
Or then, but when if you saw a person who was born into their religion, born into Islam or any other religion, and you saw them kind of doing something that you consider un-Islamic, you'd be like, oh, he's going to come back. Like, you know, they've lost their
yeah.
path temporarily. They're, so you consider it more of a journey when it's like a born, and then you consider like, oh, either you're like really devout, like a devout Muslim as a white person, or you're not Muslim right now. You've kind of lost your faith. Like it's a on and off switch almost.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very hard. I think for many people, they are kind of like silently struggling with this because you are from both sides. You are from the side of the Muslim community. There are expectations, but also from the from the non-Muslim community, you have the expectations and like both sides are kind of like squeezing you into this kind of a thing that you are supposed to be.
Right.
And even, for example, in Finland, as I have been doing, you know, my field research with Finnish converts, it's very interesting how people oftentimes kind of like self-orientalize themselves.
Right.
I don't know if that's even a word, but, you know, it's kind of like, or it's sort of maybe false consciousness. No, not false consciousness.
Like internalized, like an internalized sense of oppression. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a double consciousness. That's the word that I was looking for. A double consciousness is in my interviews, for example, I would hear women, they would tell me like, you know, I'm trying to wear clothes that are more European so that when I am walking in the streets with these kind of clothes and even, you know, they are hijabis and then they are like, oh yeah, but you can kind of like cover your body even with European style. So you don't always have to wear abaya. You don't always have to wear this khimar or whatever. And that's how you can avoid much of Islamophobia on the streets.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like they are making also that distinction between themselves and the, you know, let's say, for example, the immigrant community that,
right.
You know, they kind of would be able to, I think, you know, tarn themselves a little bit more better, you know, to become more invisible.
Right.
To the Finnish eye and not that much, you know, of a target then or being victimized.
Yeah, that's definitely double consciousness in the sense
yeah.
that, you know how you see yourself. You want to see yourself as a modest person who dresses modestly and stuff. But then you also know how the dominant views you. And so you try to constrain all your movements so that, yeah, you don't stand out as much. And
yeah.
And I also love the point that you made about like this reverence for whiteness in non-white communities or reverence for converts who are white in non-white communities where like if you've converted, you've now shown the world that this faith is worth converting to because, you know, here it is, a white person is converted. And that too can be so dangerous in terms of like wanting that proximity to whiteness, wanting that prestige attached to whiteness, attached
yeah,
to your faith.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, it's very much connected to questions of identity, of course. It's just that I think that I'm kind of, wait a minute, it must have been like 15 years that I have been Muslim.
Mashallah.
Slowly, I get quite tired of talking of myself as a convert, you know, from a theological
right.
point of view.
Right.
I, for example, I don't participate in any interviews anymore on in that manner, right? Because I just think that we have to understand that converts are just the same people as anybody else. Our religiosity, our lifestyles, they change along the years. Nobody can hold up to a steady kind of a way of life for 20, 30, 40 years, right? So I don't like to kind of like emphasize the fact that, oh, converts would be like much better Muslims or somehow more enlightened or whatever, because of course there is that intellectual struggle that you go through when you have to kind of reflect on the fact that, okay, I am believing in God and there is like this conception of God is maybe different than the one that I was taught by my parents, by my family. And then having those negotiations with yourself and most probably also with family and friends. But at the same time, it's just the, you can't, I don't know why it is that Muslims are like seeking always, you know, the communities are always seeking for something to, you know, like to enlighten their kind of like view of Islam. And if there is a convert in the community, it's like, oh, mashallah, and everybody is like, you know, here we are, you know, look at us, we have a convert in our community, you know, takbir in the mosque and stuff. I don't know. Yeah, maybe I'm being too harsh. I don't know. You tell me.
No, I mean, it's not an indictment of the communities that we are parts of, but rather it's sort of a reflection that, yes, we have great experiences, but then we also have these weird experiences where we're like, do you recognize what you're doing? So it's not like a blanket encounter that you, that, you know, one would encounter all the time, but it's like you kind of end up reflecting on how people are treating you. And so it's just that reflection. And I appreciate that. And I wanted to, like, you know, kind of, I mean, you've kind of already commented on this, but I just wanted to see if you had any final thoughts about identifying both as Muslim and as white and how that affects your positionality in the research that you're conducting.
Okay, so purely methodologically, of course, it affects it a lot. For example, the way how I was able to conduct my field research, have access to the community as such, and build rapport and get people to talk to me about their, you know, everyday experiences. Of course, it also has to do with the way I would now maybe talk, give an academic conference talk about the way how my interviewees, my participants would use certain words that we both understand. And if it was a white non-Muslim researcher, they might not use it, like something, you know, theological words, maybe, for example, if they talk about the hijab, it's fard and, you know, these kind of things. But at the same time, I think I also feel very accountable towards my own community in Finland, in the sense that there has been no research done on converts in Finland as such, you know, on a higher academic level. There's lots of master thesis, but there have been no PhD studies yet published and no books, nothing. So I am, of course, silently hoping that I would somehow be, you know, like the pioneer of this research area.
Inshallah.
But I also feel like I really want to give my community a voice, because what happens there is that the Finnish converts are in a very interesting position. If we're looking at whiteness especially, we have, okay, first of all, the Muslim community generally in Finland is not very big. The country in total has like 5.5 million inhabitants, but Muslims are somewhere around 100,000 or 150,000, so it's about 1%, if not even less. And then the convert community is, of course, even smaller. So you have like this juxtaposition of there are immigrant Muslims, and Islam has always been, you know, the immigrant Muslim religion, as it is in most of the, actually everywhere in Western, so-called Western European countries. But then at the same time, there is this little interesting community of Tatar Muslims. They are very small, about 500-600 people. It's a very small minority. They've been in the country since the beginning of the 19th century. Actually, they came back then when Finland was still annexed to Russia. We didn't have our independence yet and so on. So they came back then as soldiers, as salesmen from Russia to Finland and settled down in the country. And Tatar Muslims in Europe are, especially in the Nordic countries, in the Baltic countries, Poland, you have these, they are kind of called the white Muslims of Europe, along with the Balkan Muslims. Yeah. In Finland, the community of Tatar Muslims is very established. They have a couple of congregations. They have been there for, since a long time already, we would say. they participated in the society, you know, as fully participating citizens for a long time. But from the general, like, let's say from the general public, and also from their perspective, like from the, how do you say, from the mouths of the Tatar community themselves, there is always this kind of like juxtaposing of the immigrant Muslims and the Tatar Muslims, because the Tatars, they don't really make, we would say now, like I would put it in quotes, much noise about Islam.
Oh, I see.
They are very kind of like, as I said, secluded community. They have their businesses. They have their prayer room in Helsinki, central Helsinki. Women, I would say, barely wear the headscarf. I have been looking into media reporting of Tatar Muslims, and the way how they are always constructed are that they are the Finnishized Muslims.
Oh, so they're like closer to,
yes,
to whiteness, rational thought. They're closer to, yes, democratic values and liberal values.
Exactly. And for example, you know, some of them would give interviews to papers and be like, oh yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes we drink alcohol or something like this. So
right.
It's
to
like,
show that they're one of the good ones.
Exactly. So there is that very weird position that a Finnish convert community then is put in, because like if phenotypically the Tatar Muslims are also white, Finnish converts, I'm looking at, let's say, white Finns, okay? Right. White Finnish converts, they are also phenotypically white. However, the Tatars are more accepted as belonging to the Finnish culture as the converts are. Because the converts are basically losing all of that Finnishness the moment they start visibly practicing their religion or sticking to the rules a lot or being loud about Islamophobia and all that sorts of stuff.
Right.
So it's a very interesting constellation that we have over there at the moment. But, you know, the communities are working still together. I mean, there is lots of cooperation between different mosques, associations and all of that. But
right.
I just think
no community is homogenous, and that there is, you know, that there's heterogeneity within these communities as well.
Yeah, so. Of course. And there is no animosity as such between the communities. I'm talking purely from the point of view of if you are looking into media reporting, because this is like part of my research that I'm also doing, is like how in the media Finnish converts are portrayed. And then I'm kind of like looking into how Tatars are portrayed, because they are both like white Muslims of the country. There is definitely this juxtaposition of the Tatars as the Finnish Muslims, Finnishized Muslims. There is
right,
that process,
right,
you know,
they have managed.
They have made it like throughout these decades and the centuries, they finally made it. However, the converts, they are the crazy ones. They are still, you know, going for the headscarf, and they are going, you know, they're trying to build a mosque and where they will have the muezzin calls and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I definitely see your point. And what I'm really glad about, Linda, is that you are conducting the research from the community that you know most about. And as you said, that gives you the kind of a responsibility, a kind of accountability that somebody from the outside may not have in terms of doing justice to the voices that you are researching on. And,
right.
And that is really, really appreciated, because without that, I mean, we have other people write about us all the time.
Exactly.
And I think it's really important, the work that you're doing.
Well, I also kind of like, I have a very, very personal connection to my PhD topic, and I've been able to already publish a couple of things, and hopefully someday I will also publish my PhD thesis.
Inshallah.
And kind of like bring those voices out there that I am trying to give them the platforms for. It just remains to be seen when that will happen, I'd say, because...
No, inshallah, it's going to happen soon. You're going to graduate very, very soon. But thank you, Linda, so much for coming on, for doing this for me. I really, really appreciate it. I think the research that you're doing is essential, as I said. And I cannot wait to read the book when it does come out. Which will be soon. I tell you, it's going to be soon. So yes, the finish line is almost there. Yes, inshallah.
Yes, inshallah. Thank you so much for having me. This was really nice to talk to you about this, about my research and about my experiences. And I hope that, I don't know, inshallah, somebody will benefit from this, you know, one
definitely.
Way or the other.
Definitely. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.